This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
One of the country's leading journalists on the effects of poverty and crime is Alex Kotlowitz. You may have heard his stories on This American Life and his best-selling book, There Are No Children Here, stays with me to this day, although I think I read it first some 20 years ago. It's the story of two boys in a Chicago housing project, and it was even adapted into a television movie with Oprah Winfrey. Recently, Kotlowitz has been working with inmates at Stateville Correctional Center, a maximum security prison outside Chicago. The men at Stateville are generally serving long sentences for violent crimes. Alex asked them to write not about their crimes or how they got to jail, and not on questions of guilt or innocence, but rather to focus in on describing the cells where they spend their days. Here's one of those essays read for us by an actor. It's called A Visit from an Outsider.
After a long day of landscaping work, I walked into the cell house and stood outside my cell waiting for the gallery officer to let me in. Leaning against the bars, I noticed something moving in the back of the cell. I couldn't tell what it was because it was hiding behind the steel bunk bed. When the officer opened the door, I walked straight to the back and moved the laundry bag from the wall. To my surprise, it was a bird, a robin or a wren, I'm not sure. I'm 6'7" and 300 pounds, and when the bird caught sight of me, it undoubtedly feared for its life. It scurried away, taking cover under the bunk bed. Its little legs moved so fast that it looked like the Roadrunner character. It found safety between two gray property boxes. I couldn't help but to laugh at its cartoonish ways. I lay down on the cold concrete floor and reached under the bed to grab it, but it ran and hopped out of my reach. As I lay on the floor, it made its way to the front of the cell and jumped on a slot between the bars. It perched for a moment there. I sat up and admired its beauty. Its beak was bright yellow. Even its brown plumage amidst all the prison gray seemed colorful. Sitting on the bars, it no longer seemed afraid. It barely moved, just its head, which swiveled from left to right and back again. It seemed so delicate. Its little black eyes were no longer looking at me. Instead, it appeared it was trying to figure out which direction to fly. I hoped it would find its way out of the building, so I waved my hand, shooing it toward the door. But it flew further into the cell house. For a few minutes, I felt like I was somewhere else. It was a small crack in a routine which sets my life every day. My encounter with the bird brought a rare moment of pure joy, and so I've held on to this small memory. 10 years later, it still makes me smile.
A Visit from an Outsider, read for us by the actor Rick Walker. Journalist Alex Kotlowitz sent us the piece after he taught a writing workshop for inmates, and we published it on NewYorker.com. Now, Alex, that's a remarkable piece of writing, and I wish you could tell us a little bit about its author, James Trent, who he is and how you came to get this piece of writing from him.
Sure. So James is he's in Stateville Prison, a maximum security prison about an hour south of Chicago. And he's, I think, served a little over 20 years already. And this piece was in some ways kind of an accident in some ways. I had been asked to visit a class at Stateville run by a philosophy professor at Northwestern, Jennifer Lackey. And I came in there, actually, my intent was to talk about my first book, There Are No Children Here. They had all been given copies of it, and I went in there to talk to them about it and also to talk to them about the craft of storytelling. And in that three-hour class we had together, I asked them to do this short exercise where I asked them to write about their prison cells. And I was so taken with what some of the guys wrote that I offered for those who would take me up on it to work with them on trying to work on these pieces that were just really about sort of the everyday life of being in prison and how one gets by. And James wrote this piece, and he struggled with it. It's a small piece. It's a beautiful piece, I think. And one of the things he struggled with, he talked about this bird, and I kept on pushing him why this moment, why he was telling this story. And I remember getting back one of the drafts that he gave to me, and he talked about how the bird was, you know, symbolized freedom, and with, you know, and that he saw it fly away from the cell, and it didn't feel like him. It felt like this kind of trope that he was using. And then he hands me a draft and mentions in passing that this incident happened 10 years earlier. And I realize that that's it, that he's held onto this moment for 10 years.
Alex, the men you were working with were convicted of some really violent crimes, and James Trent is no exception. He and his former girlfriend were convicted of killing her daughter, who was 4 years old. When you were working with him, did this come up?
Right, right. With the guys I worked with, I didn't talk to any of them about their crimes, in part because I know enough that, you know, so much of their life is spent trying not to let that moment define who they are, and I haven't spoken to him about it. But I did – I happened to talk to him the other day. He calls occasionally, and I mentioned to him that I might mention his crime. And he said to me, he said that was, you know, I understand. And he said, I was more than that before I went in, and I'll be more than that before I leave.
I guess someone hearing this would say, with every good intention, here's a guy who killed a child. And I just wonder why. Why teach him? Why work with him on storytelling rather than with someone else who might profit just as well from your attentions?
Yeah. David, to be honest with you, I kind of stumbled into this. It wasn't something that was premeditated, so to speak. I agreed to come visit these guys in prison. I do this. And I was just so taken with what they had written that I thought, you know, I sort of saw it as a kind of personal challenge. Could I get something out of these guys that that resonated, that felt real and personal and felt on some level literary? I will tell you that this experience has made me want to go back in, not necessarily to Stateville, but to another prison to work with inmates on this. I mean, I realize one of the things is that given the high incarceration rate in this country, in some ways, we really don't fully understand what it means to be incarcerated, what it means to be in prison for 10, 20, 30 years.
After this essay was published, you heard from his mother, from James Trent's mother. What did she tell you?
Yeah, she called. I don't know how she got my phone number, but she called me, and she was so grateful. I think, you know, she, you know, what she saw in this essay, I think, is what she sees in her son, which is this sense of humanity, you know, this rich, full, complicated individual. She told me that, I guess, apparently at her church, one of her friends had read the piece because it ran on the New Yorker's website and had brought a copy in to distribute to all the people in the church. I could feel and hear the sense of pride she had in her son.
There was another man you work with whose mother was also particularly proud of her son's essay, and his name is Demetrius Cunningham. Let's listen to his story.
Learning to Hear on a Cardboard Piano by Demetrius Cunningham. On my bottom bunk bed, I sat in deep thought. I had an unusual problem. The prison choir that I sang in needed a piano player, and they needed one quickly. I thought to myself, how could I teach myself to play? I had no prior experience with the piano, but as a boy, I was infatuated with the instrument. I can still remember running down the hallways of my grandmother's house. Every time I ran past her old upright piano, I would slam all the keys down at the same time. Music has been my constant companion. It's like my DNA has tiny quarter notes infused into it. One day while I was watching TV in my cell, I flipped past a show on BET with a gospel singer, Andre Crouch, who described his first piano. He said it was made out of cardboard. I had an idea that was literally out of the box. I soon realized that it was tissue day. Every Tuesday, the institution hands out hundreds of rolls of tissues, one roll per inmate. I knew that there would be plenty of cardboard boxes around. I found a large empty one abandoned at the end of the gallery of cells. I tore off the top flaps and quickly went back to my cell. In church, I had taken measurements of the keyboard, so I cut a piece from the cardboard box, but it wasn't long enough. I needed 76 keys to mimic the prison's piano, so I stapled two sections of cardboard together. I then took 10 sheets of white typing paper and wrapped it around the cardboard. For the white keys, I used a black pen to outline them. For the black keys, I cut small rectangles out of black construction paper. I attached the keys with clear packing tape. By now, my cardboard piano looked so realistic that an officer walking past doing count did a double take. He was so taken aback by my piano that he walked straight into a wall. Now came the hard part. I had to somehow take the music in my head and make it real. I asked my mother to send me some beginner's piano books. The first few weeks, I mainly focused on scales, but I got really frustrated. The books that I had were too basic, and I only had access to the real piano for 1 hour on Sundays. So I called home again and asked my mother to send some professional books on chords, on harmony, and on music theory. She also threw in a Piano for Dummies book just for fun. I studied these books day and night, carrying them everywhere I went, to the yard, to the chow hall, and to choir practice. I positioned my practice space at the end of my bunk bed. I was fortunate to have the bottom bunk because I could sit on my small property box like a piano bench. I folded my mattress on itself and then placed the piano on the steel bed frame. For hours at a time, I would practice finger positions and chords. Sometimes I would hum the sound of the keys as I tapped on the cardboard. I had one cellie ask, only partly joking, "Do you need me to call a psych doctor for you?" I was making progress. Every Sunday I got to try what I learned on a real piano, but I'd be so nervous that my hands would shake so much that I'd hit the wrong keys. To hide my mistakes, I'd play softly and let the voices of the choir cover it up. I preferred playing the cardboard piano in the privacy of my cell. I discovered the formulas and equations to many of my favorite songs. Take, for instance, the song "Ribbon in the Sky" by Stevie Wonder. This song starts with a 1-2-3 chord progression. Once I figured this out, I could use it in other keys. I felt like a musical chemist, experimenting with all types of chord progressions. I was recently transferred to Pinckneyville Correctional Center. The move was unexpected. As soon as I arrived there, I saw many familiar faces from my old prison. They told me that the church choir needed a director and a piano player. I took both jobs. After I played the first church service, I told them about how I learned music. They got excited. Now I sit in my cell, on a box, next to my bunk bed composing music and building cardboard pianos for three other inmates who have accepted the pedagogy of the cardboard piano.
Alex, that's an amazing piece of writing. I wonder if it's your experience that in the best of circumstance, a prisoner finds something to take up his hours or her interests or whatever it might be, because otherwise it's a horrendous existence. What's your experience of that?
Right. I think that, you know, I think partly, and you hear this in Demetrius's piece, is that part of the experience of living in prison is you live so much in your head. You know, you try to find ways, to, as you suggest, to get by. I have one gentleman I know who spent 14 years in prison who told me that he would spend his days counting the bricks in his cell. It was sort of how he managed to get by. But this piece always makes me smile. I mean, here's this guy who was able to figure out a way to make music in his cell.
I know you're not a polemicist by nature, but I just wonder, after all these years and visits and contact with prisons and prisoners, what you think has to be done? What radical changes are necessary to our prison system, in your view?
I think we sort of have to revisit why ultimately we are putting people away. You know, we very quickly are sentencing people to 10, 20, 30, 40 years? And are we sentencing them because of punishment? Are we sentencing them because of the hope that somehow they'll be rehabilitated and find redemption? Or are we sentencing them to keep everybody else safe? And I don't think we've asked those fundamental questions. I don't know these men well. I've gotten to know them through the course of these writings. But I will say I have a hard time reconciling the individuals I met with the crimes that they committed that got them there. People change. People find, or in some cases, they find out who they really are. And I think we have to acknowledge that.
Alex, I want to thank you for this. I want to thank you for your work, which is extraordinary. And let's close with one more story called What Isn't Here by William Jones.
My cell is notable for what is not there rather than what is. I don't have a glass mirror. I have not seen a true reflection of myself in 5 years. The plastic mirrors sold in prison are small, 5 by 4 inches, and distort and cloud one's appearance. I normally cut my own hair, but every few years I go to the prison's barbershop. On this last occasion in the shop's glass mirror, I noticed for the first time some gray hair and a few deep wrinkles around my eyes. My cell is without privacy. My cell happens to be located by the door that leads into the cell house, and so at a wood desk just outside, a guard there can see everything I do. So when I use the toilet or wash up, I take a sheet from my bed and use it as a curtain. I tuck one end under my mattress on the top bunk and tie the other end to a hook I've pasted to the wall. Even though this curtain is technically against prison rules and could land me in solitary confinement for months, I take the chance. Most guards who sit outside my cell are women, and I'm sure they don't care to see me naked, so they allow the makeshift curtain. I don't have a stove or a hot plate or a microwave. Yet much of the food sold in the commissary, refried beans, rice, instant oatmeal, and ramen noodles, requires hot water. I also don't have a refrigerator. To keep things cold, like pop or a carton of milk, I place the items in the cool water of the toilet bowl. Needless to say, you need to wash the can or carton really good before drinking. It took me 15 years to finally succumb and begin using this refrigeration method. My cell is without space. I constantly bump into my cellmate. I've gotten into a few fights because of it. Once I accidentally kicked my cellmate in his head while getting off the top bunk. He became enraged and pulled me off my bed. We fought like dogs. My cell is without quiet. All day, inmates yell, guards shout orders. Guard radios blast. Inmates play music on small stereos or their televisions to full volume. This goes on all night as well. On occasion, I plug my ears with toilet paper so I can sleep. My cell is without a window. I can't see a sunrise or a sunset or a star or the moon. My cell is without a criminal. I'm now 61. The young ruffian who came into this cell ready to take on the world died a long time ago.
You can find William Jones's story and all the essays we published about life at Stateville Prison at newyorkerradio.org. They were performed by Rick Walker, Sean Paris, and Cedric Young. WBEZ, the public radio station in Chicago, has a podcast called Written Inside, featuring these stories and many more.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.